Okay, thanks a lot. So this was worked on some of it collaboration by student Charanjit Borgohain and another just beginning student Anatoly Polkovnikov, who's really very good. And Matthias Voita was involved in really everything I'm going to talk about. There's actually two Voitas, Thomas Voita and Matthias Voita, so you shouldn't confuse them. He's the younger brother, and he's terrific. And he's now back in Oxford. Let's see. Okay, so these transparencies were originally prepared for a talk to a broader audience, so don't get insulted. I'll try and keep the discussion at a level for such a distinguished audience and just keep asking questions. I'll use the board. Okay, so the general theoretical framework I'm going to use is the following. So we want to, of course, understand many, many experiments and what happens when you dope an antiferromagnet like lanthanum copper oxide. And the particular experiments I'm going to focus on a whole series of experiments looking at various probes as to what happens when you replace one of the copper ions by a non-magnetic zinc or lithium ion. So at the level of my discussion will be that this is just some, essentially a vacancy in which there's no spin, and this vacancy is not allowed to move. And then you can locally go in and look at what's happening near the vacancy by STM or NMR, and also and look at average properties by neutron scattering. So the theoretical framework I'm going to use is to imagine, first of all, is to of course not address this very hard problem. Imagine we have some other axis, and we can use that axis to first of all get rid of the magnetic order. So there's a phase transition here at which the magnetization goes to zero temperature. This is not temperature. And you get some other quantum paramagnetic state on this side. And there's, as we've already discussed, there's a number of very interesting candidates for these quantum paramagnets, and I'll briefly at least discuss them in two different categories. And once you have decided on what the right state is on this side, then one can imagine what happens when we dope. And the hope, of course, is that this two-step process is reasonable enough that you get some meaningful information for the physical system. Now, one sort of theoretical idea that will underlie many of the things I'm going to say is that now I can imagine drawing a phase boundary where the magnetic order first vanishes. For example, in LSCO, we know that you have commensurate order here, but that quickly it becomes incommensurate, and eventually there's some point at which the incommensurate order becomes short range. So you can imagine drawing a phase boundary where you have various types of magnetic order here. So SU2 symmetry is broken, and here where SU2 symmetry is not broken. And sort of the underlying, this whole philosophy is going to be reasonable if in some sense things don't change too much across this line. So I'm going to spend a lot of time talking about this transition. And the hope is that once we understand this transition, perhaps what happens across this line is also at least not too far away. So the first part of my talk, I'm going to just talk about insulators, just so that everyone's on the same wavelength, and I apologize for the very elementary discussion. So as I said, we're going to look at paramagnetic states of two-dimensional insulators, and I'll just sort of make some cartoon pictures, not to be taken too literally, on the various two types of states that one can think of. And I'll also then talk about how these insulating states respond to zinc impurities or non-magnetic impurities. And there we'll find that there are actually very interesting differences in the effects of impurities. So then the hope is, of course, having understood insulators and impurities here, that perhaps it's not too much of a stretch to then understand the effect of zinc impurities in the doped system. Then I'll sort of discuss how that argument will run. And the main part, so this and the main part of the talk then will be reviewing a series of experiments, NMR experiments especially of Ariel Luhl. I don't know if he's visited this workshop, probably not. And then somewhat old neutron scattering experiments of Bernhard Kaimer, which actually first got us interested in all these issues. And the heart of the new theoretical calculation of this talk is really buried in here. A lot of this is background stuff and things done a long time ago, which we resurrected, I guess, in a sense. And then I'll also talk about briefly STM experiment of Seamus Davis. I know Sasha also has done a lot of important work on that subject, and I'm sure you have comments, and we can discuss that today and perhaps also continue next week on that issue. Okay, so one model that has been studied quite a bit over the last decade of a paramagnetic insulating state is if you take a square lattice Heisenberg antiferromagnet and put in a second neighbor exchange. We argued quite a while ago that if there's a continuous transition at which the magnetic order is lost, then the state on the other side has certain characteristics, one of which is that it does have broken translational symmetry, and one very likely state for that broken translational symmetry is the spin parallel state. Basically, it's a state in which spin singlets form preferentially along between these two sides than these two sides. And then these singlets line up in this columnar order. Now, this is also a stripe state, as Steve just discussed. If I were to look at the properties of the oxygen on this side, it would have a mean charge density that would be different from the oxygen on this side. So it's an oxygen-centered charge density there, if you wish. And there's been, as I mentioned, a whole series of work. There's two recent papers, a series expansion by Shushkov et al., and this density DMRG calculation by a group at Leiden. Both see rather strong evidence for some kind of broken symmetry on this side, possibly with some Plaquette order coexisting with the spin pile state. But the basic point that I want to emphasize and we'll use quite a bit is that there's not rigorous, semi-rigorous arguments that if there's just a continuous phase transition, the first state you get on the other side is of this type. You could get other more complicated states, flux phases and so on, perhaps when you put in a Plaquette term. But in all cases, if you just have a continuous transition, the first state is of this type.
But see, your transition is a function of the second to the first neighbor exchange.
Why
is that the same as doping the system?
Okay, we'll come to that later. Let me just talk about insulators right now.
And these statements are about continuous transitions.
Right. Sort of they could, of course, yes. Right. If you make first order condition, you could almost anything on the other side. So since I'm going to be drawing this columnar picture a lot, mainly to make some very simple arguments using cartoon pictures, let me just review some very old arguments as to why is it that this columnar state might be preferred. Basically, it's one of an RVB type idea, if you wish. Of course, when you have this particular state starting out, you have many, many plaquettes around which the diamonds can resonate. So this state can resonate to that state, and you can do that over any plaquette you want. But if you pick some arbitrary diamond covering, there's only a few spots where this resonance can win, like here. Of course, this is not the complete argument. Now, it requires looking at the energetics and the dynamics of this kind of model more carefully. And in fact, you can map it onto models proposed by Roxar and Kivelson, the dimer model, and through, again, a fairly solid argument on models of this type, you can argue that this effect always wins in models where you have this bipartite type of singlet bonds appearing. And one of the interesting things are the effective models you get by duality transforms on these dimer models or by starting from the O3 nonlinear sigma model are essentially going to be exactly the same. And they all predict that in 2 plus 1 dimensions, this kind of RVB state actually preferentially breaks translational symmetry and picks out columnar diamonds of this type. All right, so very quickly, let's talk about some of the basic properties of a state like this. What are the excitations? So one excitation, you break a singlet bond, form a triplet, and these two spins now can't move far apart because they'll leave a trail of bonds that are out of registry with the columnar order, and this will cause some energy per unit length. So these are the spin-ons, and they're confined by a linear potential. So even this very simple picture can show you how that happens. If you prefer, there are certain gauge theories you can write down, U1 gauge theory, that give you essentially the same physics. Now what about when you put in zinc impurities? Well, you can make a very similar argument. Let's put in a pair of zinc impurities, move them far apart. Then if you insist on writing down a ground state, which is in the singlet subspace, then you'll be forced to have a string of bonds again that are not quite registered with the columnar order. And so eventually, when these are far apart, it'll pay to just forget about the green bonds, have only blue bonds, for the cost of having a free moment next to every zinc. If you prefer another language, the zinc is a static holon, which has a U1 gate chart. The spin-on also has a U1 gate chart. You only want neutral objects, and so that means the holon will bind a spin-on if you have a confining state. This is a pictorial representation of that same physics. So literally what this means is that if you look at the ground state of a system like this, the ground state is of course always a singlet, but because of these free moments, there'll be one very low-lying triplet state, which is just there's of course some effective interaction between these, which is exponentially small. So you're going to get a new triplet coming in very low in energy. And this kind of moment can, of course, there's no trouble seeing this in experiments. You just have to measure the magnetic susceptibility. You'll see a Curie-like susceptibility.
Do you know that the ground state has to be a singlet, even though you have...
Okay. If the ground state could be a triplet, too, but
yeah.
There are four states, very low in energy.
Yeah.
And if they're an opposite sublattice, it's most likely the ground state is a singlet. And if they're in the same sublattice, then it could be a triplet.
Uh-huh.
But there's four states corresponding to this spin up and down, that spin up and down. Sorry, thank you. With long range order.
Okay.
Yeah, well, then there's really not much that happens. If you have an classically, you have an antiferromagnet. Let's go to the classical limit. You make a hole, it doesn't change much. It changes chi perp a little bit, a finite amount. So there's some finite chi perp in the nail state, which changes a finite amount when you put a vacancy. Now, as you approach the critical point to the disordered state, the shift in chi perp diverges. It goes to infinity at the critical point, and then on the other side, you have a susceptibility of a vacancy, which is Curie-like down to t equals zero. So I could, I don't want to get sidetracked, and we've worked that crossover out in great detail, but that's the short answer. Okay, so now let me go to the other candidate, spin on the confinement. So one possible state, one situation where this sort of state has been realized is in very nice recent work, I guess you heard about recently, by Sondi, and there's also work on Heisenberg models by Mifkovich and Lhuillier. We looked at a triangle lattice model with fair amount of ring exchange, motivated mainly by experiments on helium-3. So you can imagine, again, this kind of RVV-like state in which now these spin-a-half spin-ons are free to move apart. And so this is a deconfined state, which means there is no confinement of these spin-on charges. So if you put in a zinc insert of the spin-on, one likely possibility, not the only possibility, is that there is no free moment near the zinc. So what this would mean, that if you diagonalize, look at the spectrum of the system with two impurities, you have a well-formed spin gap without the impurities. You put in two impurities, you still have a nice spin gap with a small change in it. You don't have these four states coming in immediately with one with spin 1 and one with spin 0. In fact, I know that they've done this test on their on the triangle lattice model, Mifkovich and Lhuillier, and that's precisely what they see. Now, it's possible, of course, that even in this model without confinement, that you could just have a moment be bound around to zinc. So you can't rule out absolutely that in a deconfined spin liquid state that there isn't a moment. Whether there's a moment or not is a sharp distinction, because you can measure the susceptibility, and if there's a Curie law, there is a moment. If there isn't, if it diverges as chi goes to t goes to zero, then there is a moment. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So this is a weak point in my argument, but that's it. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah.
Even number of sides.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm imagining there's some small anisotropy that pins the nail order.
Right.
If you don't have don't have any pinning and the whole nail order is allowed to fluctuate, then what you'll find is that the impurity has a moment which is, well, it turns out that the impurity is susceptibility in a fully rotationally averaged nail state with the chalk. This is a hypertechnical point, but in the nail state, well, okay, let's talk about the paramagnetic state. In the paramagnetic state, you get S into S plus 1 over 3T. That is the Curie law. But in the nail state, if you really didn't even pin the long range order and allowed to fluctuate all the way around, you get a susceptibility which is really S squared I squared over 3T. That it's really, the moment has a, there is a net spin and a half moment there, but it's really not, it's like a classical moment. It behaves just like a single classical vector. And so this is just the classical susceptibility of a moment of length S, where this is from quantum. So there is a difference.
Wait.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thermodynamic limit, it shouldn't matter if you like in the spin of this quarter state, should it? Why does it?
I don't understand. Well, you're talking about it. Well, if you pin this, if you don't allow the nail moment to fluctuate, then in fact there is no response parallel to the moment, and perpendicular to the moment is a chi perp, which is finite.
No, but I could turn on a small symmetry breaking field, do the calculation, take the limit as the field goes to zero.
Well, I would claim that those limits don't commute. T goes to zero and the small symmetry breaking field goes to zero don't quite commute.
Okay.
For this impurity susceptibility. Okay. This is why I didn't want to get into this. Yes.
So, the fact that there is this demobilized, or it could be like 1 over 1 in that?
No, the moment is localized in both sides, but here it's a classical moment, here it's a quantum moment, and only at the critical point does it diverge. And at the critical point, in fact, you get an irrational spin. Okay, I don't know if I satisfied you, but I mean, I think the physical answer is that you always pin the moment. You pin the orientation of the nail state by some infinitesimal anisotropy. There's always something. And then the susceptibility measure the chi perp, and that's just finite. But, and you take the same system with the infinitesimal anisotropy and go to the paramagnetic side, then you get a Curie. You would get a Curie law in the confined state, and most likely not a Curie law in this kind of deconfined state.
If the low energy excitation in this deconfined state is spin 1 rather than 2 separate then well, that would be an exception.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, there's still a state where the moment doesn't form. I mean, it's not as if you're actually taking all these spin, the bulk spin-on gap has nothing to do with the ground state of the state with one impurity.
Presumably the difference.
I mean, it is related to the point I just mentioned. You're right. I mean, there is a loophole. But so the precise statement is that for a confined state, a moment must necessarily form. For a deconfined state, it could be either way, but I believe it's most likely scenario that it doesn't form.
But certainly, you can take the spin gap as big as you like here.
Yes.
If the spin gap big enough, it'll be this.
That's right. Yeah. Because you just have so many, the singlets will just rearrange a bit. It doesn't cost very much energy for the singlets to rearrange. You don't really actually, what that's happening is these things, it's not as if you're taking this, of creating a spin on and then binding, and, Sorry. That's why I said liquid, right?
Make sure I understand. Yeah. You said in a confined state, a spin, a moment, local moment must form.
Yes.
So, presumably, okay, with a confined state, that half filling.
The insulator, yes.
I mean, if I had a band insulator, I presume to be needed.
Mod insulator, I'm talking about a mod insulator, right, okay.
But then, suppose I go into a spin pile type state where I double the unit cell.
Yes.
In the broken, in the low temperature.
Yes. I'm pretty sure you'll get it there too.
But isn't that smoothly connected to some band insulator?
Okay.
Then what's the sharp distinction?
This is all paramagnetic states.
It's a spin pile.
Okay. Yeah. So how do you get a band insulator without having a doubling of the unit cell?
Let's suppose I had a model in which the columnar walls are smaller than the.
Yes.
It could be an insulator, and
yes.
That's
I believe would have the same physics. You put in one impurity, you would get a moment. I mean, just the broken symmetry is actually enough to give you the moment.
But it's different if that was explicit symmetry breaking in your Hamiltonian, that you had alternating bonds on every other.
I don't think so. I don't think it's different because. Well, I mean, suppose this was explicit, then it's even easier. Then the green bonds just don't like to be there.
Right.
You don't have to worry about all this resonance and all the subtle effects.
I hate to do this, but I believe the anti-ferromagnet, if you pin it, won't have a susceptibility that goes like one of the two.
Yeah. Well, of course it doesn't. I agree with you.
So, I'm sorry, this is what?
This is without pinning. If you allow the global nail, see what happened, okay, you're getting caught on this. So, if you have a nail state, then let's treat it classically. It's just a classical system. So, if I have a big nail state with ups and downs, and it's a classical spin, then I create one impurity, and I have, let's say I have an even number of spin, then this whole system has spin a half. It has a moment. You put it in a magnetic field, this whole moment behaves like a single classical moment. If you allow it to rotate, it'll give you the classical susceptibility of a moment of length 1/2, which is why it's s squared and not s into s plus 1. That's all this trivial answer is. Of course, if physically this whole thing never rotates, so it's pinned, then the answer is finite. It's just Kuiper with some constant, and it actually diverges in a universal way as you approach the critical point.
Severe.
Yeah.
Can I come back to Sandro's question?
Okay, sure.
I'm not sure you understood the point you're trying to make.
Probably not.
I mean,
okay.
If you take the model and you, by hand, dimerize the strength of the bond.
Right.
And then you'll get your diamond ground state.
Yeah.
But you could presumably smoothly by reducing U, the strength of interaction, other model,
tune
into a non-interacting band insulator.
Okay.
With two sites per unit cell, right?
Right. Okay.
And
yes.
Smoothly, without the gap wouldn't close. I mean, that you can deform your.
All right. Okay.
And then take that band insulator, there's non-interacting electrons in a.
Non-interacting electron.
Well, that's a band insulator. Take U from infinity down to zero.
Well, I don't know what you mean by non-magnetic impurity.
It's
look.
It has to be an infinite on-site impurity.
Yes. I don't know what you.
Allow no electrons onto that zinc.
I know. Yeah. So then, you move a site from a band insulator.
Okay.
You get a local moment.
I mean,
you get a state in mid gap.
I mean,
you might, actually.
Implicit in my discussion is, you know, when I say non-magnetic impurity, it means that that I have a large U. I don't know what that meaning, what the meaning of the word non-magnetic impurity is.
So the large U on that side, too?
On all the sides.
It's large potential.
Okay. I mean, this is an interesting question, but
Okay.
I think. For this model, the J1, J2 Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet, what I'm saying is absolutely correct.
So, for the model for zinc now, you have even larger U?
No, I just remove a spin. I talk about anti-ferromagnets, I just remove a spin. That's all. It's easy to do on the computer. Just take a two states on every site, and just remove a site and diagonalize it, see what happens. I always assume an even number, because once you have an odd, then you work with even number. This is why I put
even number before you remove the spin, so you always remove the odd number after you.
No, this is why I remove two. This is why I remove two. I always was careful to have two, just to make sure every time. Yes. But assuming they're far enough apart, then these.
Why should you give me that annoyance?
Twice. Anyway, so I've done this part. Now we're. Okay, so now let's do the hard part, which is doping. So let's start from either of these two states. So. I don't have any zinc impurities as yet. So if you start from the columnar state and dope, then through a variety of approaches, you can see that what you get is basically a conventional VCS state with some coexisting stripe or charge density wave order. One way to see it is that, you know, these holons both have on opposite sublattices have opposite charges, so will bind to form a charge neutral object. This is point of view taken by Ferkin and Kibbleson many years ago. And so you get basically a very conventional state with both BCS and stripe order of some type. The other possibility is if you start with a deconfined ferromagnet, I'm not going to say much more about this, but I'm going to basically work with this framework and see what happens with Zeke impurities. You get a superconductor which is conventional, but as we discussed just an hour ago, but there can be some very interesting properties that Senthil and Matthew have been emphasizing over the last year, flux trapping, and closely related to that are issues that you could get regimes in the superconductor in a very low doping regime where just energetically it seems that you could have prefer H over E vortices over H over 2E vortices. Now, this is all very interesting, and of course I would love to see this be correct. And to increase the chances of that, Matthew and I decided to appeal to higher authorities. Anyway, we'll see if that works. So
you want to use some V2.
Who's that in the background?
You don't know. This is Rio de Janeiro.
Oh, okay.
All right, so if I work with the confined case, so you start out with a spin power state and start doping. So for example, I imagine our phase diagram as a function of doping and say the second ever exchange. In practice, what we really, this axis is large N and the SPN large N method, but okay, this particular state at least has been shown to exist both in large N and in the J2, J1 model. So when you dope this, you get, so the symbols here, the straight line is a measure of the exchange energy of that bond, or you could also view it as a signal of the symmetry of the charge on the oxygen sides. And the circles are the charges on the copper side. So you could get various states, all of where you'd have a period P where the charges are preferentially in regions of period Q, and you get all kinds of arbitrary complicated phase diagrams with states of this type. And this one very interesting state that comes back over a certain regime of parameters is essentially the state with essentially the same symmetry, the spin power order, but with superconductivity coexisting. And eventually there's some line at which the charge translational symmetry is restored. And so Steve also discussed various transitions between these states and their states that many people are now studying. The physical region is of course down here, and here we start with a magnetically ordered state with spin rotational symmetry breaking. And once you dope, that magnetic order presumably becomes incommensurate, and actually very low doping, there's probably some Wigner crystal state, which I haven't drawn here, even down here. And eventually and if that order is incommensurate, that coexists also with some kind of charge density wave, and there's a transition here where the spin rotation symmetry is restored, and presumably a second transition where a translational symmetry is restored. So what I'm going to do is use this kind of picture to argue about continuity, say in this regime here, in states of this type or fluctuating order of this type, or even actually down here, of the effect of zinc impurities.
The blue line is a continuous phase transition?
Well, it could be continuous or first order.
But it could be continuous.
Sure.
But these others are first order between the different period strikes.
They're first order.
Yeah.
This could be continuous, but at that point, related to our earlier discussion, the nodal particles won't have any interesting behavior. It will just be in the charge density sector.
Right.
And somewhere in there, there may be a D plus ID state too that's also preferred by the second ever exchange.
What's the nature of the transition out of the antiferromagnet? Is it antiferromagnet insulated directly to D wave superconductor?
Sorry, where are you?
J2 of J1 equals zero, I guess.
Here?
Yeah, following that line across.
Well, there's still an antiferromagnet here.
Uh-huh, and then there's a shaded area.
Okay, so this transition, all right, so as long as the spin order is collinear, that is some kind of incremental spin density with a polarization that, that has only one direction and not a spiral. Then the transition here is essentially the same as the transition here. I guess the one exception being if somehow the antiferromagnetic wave vector exactly nests any gapless quasi-particle excitation in the superconductor. But if it doesn't, then basically I think that's essentially continuous all along that line.
And so is that shaded region is coexisting spin order and superconductivity?
Right. Everything.
Right. And charge translation, charge.
Right.
Okay.
They're
all there.
Okay.
Well. Assuming that in the shaded region.
Yeah. The ground state is essentially always, except there might be some insulators down here from because of Wigner crystal states. Yeah.
So,
no, this circuit. The only thing I know is this. That's all.
Everything below is guesswork.
It's a guesswork, right?
This is not a calculation.
No.
It's just a deep breath.
You want to see the real calculations? I have some. Up here is calculations.
Oh, up there.
This is calculations. This is just a schematic summary of our calculations. Down here is scenarios. Okay. All right. Okay. I don't know whether I should do this. All right. Now you'll see it. I have to do it. So I want to thank Steve for drawing my attention to a certain experiment. Now, I'm not an experimentalist, and I'm just going to report this for what it's worth. I think you've heard a lot of discussion of various new neutron scattering experiments. And this is something that came out last year, and it's intriguing, it's by no means conclusive, and I'm sure there will be further studies, so let me just the purpose of the next two transplants is just to draw your attention to this, and I'm not necessarily drawing any conclusions from it. So this was a measurement by McQueenie et al., Professor Yami's group at Penn, where they looked at phonons, optical phonons in LSCO, optimally doped LSCO. So basically, they're looking at as these two vibrational modes. So this is oxygen and there's copper. This is a new mode at Q equals zero, where all the oxygen go one way and all the coppers go the other way. And this is a vibrational mode in which the oxygens go against each other while the coppers remain stationary. So this is at Q equals zero, this is at Q equals pi. So if you look at this mode at high temperature, 300 Kelvin, from 0 to pi, that's the red dots. You seem to see some fairly well-defined peaks going smoothly from this oscillation to that oscillation. But as you lower the temperature, what you seem to be seeing is some kind of band gap opening where the red dots are turned into the purple dots. You get a sharp peak here, then you see nothing in between, and you see abrupt jump, apparently, which is in this data here, to this other mode. And their interpretation, which at this point is still an interpretation, not any firm conclusion, is that this is some kind of Bourgoin zone boundary corresponding to a doubling of the unit cell.
Excuse me, these are just powder densities or states?
No, this is not powder. There's a single crystal and a third Bourgoin zone.
So what Q are they in?
Okay, so these are the real Qs here, 3.5 to 3.1 in reciprocal lattice units. Along this direction. Now, there's actually this mode here is a mode where the oxygens go this way vertically, and that has no interesting signal from the normal to the superconducting state. The light blue blind is a tiny peak that they do also see below at 10K, which you can you would view as a reflection about the zone folding. Right. I mean, I think this is a very interesting experiment and deserves much further study. That's really all I can say, in addition to all the others we heard about. Anyway, so again, these are plots from their paper. They did a simple ball and spring calculation of the copper and oxygen, treating them in hard spheres coupled with springs, and they put in this kind of symmetry modulation. This is, again, a figure from their paper. So you notice the oxygens, high density, low density, high density, low density. I would like to interpret that as really the singlet bonds are forming here and here and there and not across these. And this is the simple theoretical model which gives you something like the experimental spectrum with this continuity and the finite energy resolution built in. Anyway, so this is whatever it's worth. There is some. This is a stripe state seen in the stripe fluctuations in the superconductor, which is a somewhat different configuration from the stripes that we generally talked about with long range spin order in the neodymium material. Okay, how am I doing on time? Okay, okay, great. So let me get back to the interesting case of what happens with impurities. So using this framework as a background, but now getting to more firm discussion. So imagine now, not really specifying exactly what happens as you dope. Let me just ask, so what happens near a zinc impurity? Could be all kinds of translational symmetry breaking, you know, staggered flux or all kinds of things possible. But one can ask, let's put an impurity in the insulator and just measure the response as a function of doping. And there's a sharp question, does the susceptibility have a QA divergence if T goes to zero or not? The one possibility is that you take this insulator with confinement, which is case A, and put an impurity. The moment you dope, immediately at zero doping, Steve pointed out to me, the moment disappears. That's possible, but I'll show you from experiments that it's quite clear that's not what happens. The reason being, I mean, the zinc is zinc 2 plus, has charge 2, and the whole, so what I'm trying to say is that now if I put in holes, one thing could happen, that hole could just, a single hole could come and sit right there, and the moment's gone. But it's unlikely to happen because they're both positively charged and the zinc will actually repel the holes. And so excluding that boring possibility in a sense, then what should happen? Okay, that wasn't or.
I'm just saying, I'm surprised to hear him suggest a boring carrot. It's not in character.
I knew he could kill it.
Then, so when you dope, now if I was doping to a Fermi liquid, then again, the moment may form, but there's always a Kondo effect. And eventually, once there's a Kondo effect in my language, there is no moment because as T goes to zero, the susceptibility is finite. But in a D-wave superconductor, because the density of states vanishes linearly at low energies, or there's a gap if there's some stripe order, in either case, you expect the moment to survive up to critical doping. And if that critical doping is at a point where you have linear, where you have gapless nodal fermions, then you have actually a phase transition, a critical point, which has been studied in somewhat different contexts over the last few years. I mean, I think Witthoff and Fragman were the first to point this out, although their original scenario, the expansion for this critical point is really doesn't work for this physical case of linearly vanishing density of states. And it was really Ingersant and his student who made some very important observations of how the particle hole symmetry breaking is a very relevant perturbation. And once you have any particle hole symmetry breaking, there is such a critical point for this particular problem. And so, in fact, the greater the particle symmetry breaking, the less likely the moment formation. So all delta has to do is change the degree of particle hole symmetry breaking, and you'd get a phase here with a moment and a quantum critical point near the impurity to a phase without a moment. And of course, at very high doping, just becomes an ordinary BCS superconductor, where we can already see from many other ways that there should be no such singular response. And this critical point really is a completely open problem, not well understood, so I think it'd be very interesting to have more work on it. In the other case, which admittedly I've set up as a straw man because not being completely fair, but in any case, the one scenario is if you don't have a moment here, you don't expect a moment way out there, so really nothing happens, you don't see any response, any singular response near an impurity. Okay, so now let me go to the experiments. So there have been NMR experiments on such zinc impurities for a long time, going back to some actually very fundamental original work of Finkelstein, Katev, Kukovetsky, and Tittlebaum. But just over the summer, we finally had some very beautiful results in the superconducting phase itself. Almost all the other work has been in the normal state. And this is work of the group of Henri Alloul in OSE. So what he's plotting, so he puts in a lithium impurity and measures the night shift on lithium-7, and that's a measure of the local susceptibility, not the total moment, but the local susceptibility of on the lithium side itself. They've also done squid measurements of the total susceptibility, and from that, they can measure the total moment. And they find a moment of spin a half, very close to spin a half. So what's plotted here is the inverse night shift, or the inverse susceptibility, 1 over chi local. And in the under-doped regime, what you see is something going right through the origin so that's chi going as 1 over t. So that's, if you wish, experimental proof that we have a diverging chi as t goes to 0, and there is a moment. Now, when you increase the doping, go to optimal doping, then the susceptibility decreases, this 1 over chi. And in the normal, and the other point is that there's a superconducting sample, but there's no sign of TC anywhere. It doesn't really matter whether you're normal or superconducting. You don't see it in the local response near lithium impurity. If you're in the optimal doping, then there's a smaller susceptibility with roughly the same slope. So one crude interpretation is this is some kind of Fermi liquid, and this intercept minus theta is some measure of the condo temperature of that Fermi liquid, so that if this went all the way down to t equals 0, the chi would be finite, doesn't go to the origin anymore. And so that's as if the moment doesn't exist, but there's some signature of it anyway, higher temperatures. But what you see now is that TC, there's a sudden drop or a sudden increase in the susceptibility. That's reasonable because the density of states fermionic excitation has gone way down. And now it seems to saturate at some finite value. So one can view this measurement here with 1 over chi going to 0, and here 1 over chi goes to finite value as being on two different sides of this critical point. So the underdoped is here, and the overdoped is over there. Okay.
So yeah. You're supposed to interpret that drop that PC is the condo temperature has suddenly discovered it's going to be lower than in thought.
That's right. So this is here, you have a finite density at the Fermi level, so you have the condo physics of a Fermi liquid.
Yeah.
You have the condo physics of a D-wave superconductor.
Right.
And the screening is, of course, much weaker.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very fun. This is actually a huge increase in a response. So it's misleading to plot 1 over chi.
Yeah. How does the moment actually increase at that point?
The moment, what do you mean? How do you define the moment?
The gradient remains the same, you're going to say, but it's just that the theta.
That's right, yeah. If the slope is some measure, if you wish, of the moment. But this is a local susceptibility. It's not just the response on one side. To get the moment, you have to measure the total response. You need a different measurement for that. You have to actually measure the magnetization with the squid. And they've also done that, not with OTC. And very clearly, they see both for zinc and nickel, a moment of spin a half. Okay, so there's also some other work from Grenoble, very similar but in the normal state, and there with some very ingenious analysis of night shift. So this was on zinc impurity, and I looked, I think, at yttrium NMR on various sites. I don't know, was it must have been copper, and then did an inverse transform of all the night shifts to figure out a spatial distribution of the moment. And so the idea that this whole object here is a moment of spin a half, but it's spatially distributed, so it's not like the cartoon picture I was drawing earlier. And it could be perfectly isotropic. So this could be in a regime where there's no transtrational symmetry breaking or any symmetric order or automatic order of any type. I don't anticipate that this transition coincides with any of the bulk transition. It seems to be rather quite independent. Okay, so that's NMR. And I have 15 minutes. Okay, so then let me also talk about neutron scattering. So what the experiment we looked at here was the effect of zinc impurity on the resonance mode. And the perspective we are taking, which surely is questionable, but I think not unreasonable, is that this resonance mode is somehow continuously connected in some way to the spin triplet excitation of the confined insulator. Of course, once you dope, you've got nodal fermions, but all kinds of other complicated things happening, and the other degrees of freedom surely are important for the appearance of incommensurate peaks, and the incommensurate response But provided, I mean, the essential ingredient in the calculation, asymptotically anyway, where's that picture? The main point is that as long as the universality of this critical point is the same as the universality of this one, our theory works asymptotically close to this transition. And the resonance mode is some mode which at some wave vector, not necessarily pi, goes to zero as you approach this phase boundary, the energy of it. That's sort of the assumption between underlying the calculation. Okay, so what I want to do is now, of course, take this resonance mode measurement, put in some impurities. So before we do that, our field theory for the resonance mode is just some simple phi-fourth field theory of a vector order parameter. And so again, this because phi is a three-component vector, the assumption is that the order parameter, even though it may be incommensurate, is collinear. And so the most simplest field theory for a collinear order parameter leading to a paramagnetic state is this simple phi-fourth field theory. And this has an excitation spectrum in the gap phase where R is greater than zero with an infinitely sharp mode above some energy delta. And we're going to look at what happens to this infinitely sharp mode as you put in some zinc impurities in the limit of small delta. So I guess if necessary, in a superconductor, the reason I can ignore the nodal fermions, the psi 2 fermions, the psi 1 fermions here, is because this phi mode being at some wave vector q will scatter this fermion from this point, say, to that point p, and this is some high energy state. So it's just some virtual fluctuation which doesn't really lead to any broadening, just changes the dispersion spectrum of this phi mode. And the phi mode could be rigorously, you can easily cook up situations which are not that different from the experiments, in which the phi is infinitely sharp as t goes to zero, even in a D-wave superconductor. All right, so let me skip that. So let me put in an impurity. So the experiments done last year were they put in a small number of zinc ions, 0.5%, and saw a dramatic broadening at low temperatures of the resonance peak. We also see a number of interesting things above TC, where the resonance peaks seem to survive at much higher temperatures. I'm not going to address any of those issues at all. I'm pretty sure that our framework is much too limited for that, since it only focuses on one degree of freedom, the collective spin excitations and superconducting order and thermal fluctuation is surely important for all those physics. But I would claim that near this magnetic ordering transition, there is a rather precise calculation one can perform at zero temperature, which helps us estimate what the broadening scale as a function of the concentration of zinc should be. And that's the calculation I'm going to describe. Yes, any questions on that? All right, so what is the effect of a zinc impurity in this field theory for the magnetic ordering transition? So we have a bulk system described by this three-component field phi, and when phi is disordered on the paramagnetic state, phi has, if you break the symmetry of spin rotation ratio, it's a magnetically ordered state. And then you're going to couple this to a zinc impurity. Now, the most important thing about the zinc impurity, of course, is this has a net moment of spin a half near it. Doesn't really matter where it is. It's when you add up the net spins around here, they have a spin a half. Another way to say it, if you try to write on some partition function for the time evolution of the spins, each spin at a certain Berry phase it picks up when it precesses around the sphere in spin space, which is proportional to the area on the surface of the sphere. And in an antiferromagnet, those Berry phases almost exactly cancel. But near the impurity, there's exactly a deficit of spin a half that doesn't cancel. So you have to include that. And that's really the basic argument. So that's this Berry phase. There is a Berry phase of spin a half associated with some impurity spin degree of freedom, which I represent by unit vector n. And then there's a coupling, Kondo-like coupling. This is just a Kondo spin, just a fancy way of writing on a Kondo spin, if you wish, coupling to this bosonic mode, phi alpha linearly. And so this is some sort of a Bose Kondo model, if you wish, where we're looking at where you have a Kondo spin coupling not to a Fermi liquid or a D-wave superconductor, but to this non-trivial interacting quantum field theory. And there are interactions even in the bulk, in addition to the boundary. So this is a field theory which we believe we have understood quite thoroughly in a two-loop RG, and has a fixed. So there's one phase transition which is in the bulk as R goes from positive to negative values, and near the phase transition we can compute all the response functions associated with the impurity. And one of the, I believe, sort of very interesting property of this theory is that this coupling gamma along with this coupling G both go to fixed point values. That is, there's a Wilson-Fisher fixed point for G, and there's a corresponding fixed point also for gamma. What this means is that, effectively, to describe the impurity spin dynamics, you don't need any new parameters. You just need to know the bulk spin gap and the bulk spin air velocity and the number of impurities, and that's it. At low energies, everything is completely universal because the coupling of the bulk to the boundary degrees of freedom is universal. And it's this kind of universal theory is what we address, for example, to address the crossover between these susceptibilities on the two sides of the transition. Okay, everyone's very quiet, so either I'm going too fast or sorry. Look. Okay, all right, then I'll quit. So one, for example, in this theory, one thing we can address is how the mode broadens. So for example, without impurities, you have some, in the paramagnetic phase, you have a pole at some energy delta at the antiferromagnetic wave vector. So with impurities of density and imp, this is going to get broadened at some energy scale gamma. So you can imagine there's some new energy scale that appears. That's roughly the scale of the broadening. So what is gamma? Now, the basic result is this one right here. And it really follows from the fact that we have this fixed point of this particular theory where G and gamma take finite fixed point values. And the statement that there are no new parameters. So once you realize there are no new parameters to play with, you just simply want to create an energy scale that depends on the density of impurities linearly. And the only thing available to you are the spin wave velocity and the gap delta. And that's really the only combination that gives you an energy scale. It's really as simple as that. Actually, there's another way to write this, which is also quite, I think, interesting. You could say gamma over delta is n imp h bar c over delta squared, and this is nm times some length squared c squared. But this is the inverse q factor, and you can view the inverse q factor as the volume of holes in the Swiss G, or the fractional volume of holes in a Swiss cheese model. So basically, each impurity is poking out a hole about the spin correlation length, and just the fractional volume is sort of the only dimensionless parameter you have, no exchange constant, no other coupling constant. And it's that dimensionless parameter that determines the width of the line.
And it'll be the same for the Q width of the...
Right, right. Well, there'll be a C, yeah. C times this, the velocity will come in. Well, I mean, this is admittedly a rather specialized model, but I think it's a model you can completely solve everything. And it could certainly be a starting point for adding in more complications, which possibly change the universality class. But anyway, so we did put in some numbers, and we were quite happy to get. So this is with no free parameter. Just take the values from the experimental paper, and this combination gives you basically something that's very close. So anyway, it'd be very interesting to check this further. For example, you can now vary the doping, so change delta, change the concentration, and see if it follows this particular scaling. And this scaling really is, I think, provided you have a fixed point, even if it's a fixed point, more complicated system, the scaling arguments are really much more robust.
So do you take the spin wave velocity to be that of the undoped system?
Well, rigorously speaking, the spin wave velocity is this velocity of the z equals 1 quantum critical point, that if there is some velocity at the critical point.
Right.
But we took the value from the undoped system. Yeah. That's correct. That's a reasonable estimate.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, so finally, let me talk about a third experiment, which I think we'll have more discussion on Wednesday, so I won't spend much time on it. Maybe I can talk about this again at that time, I suppose, which are the beautiful STM experiments of Seamus Davis. So where he takes the impurity and measures the tunneling, I think almost everyone here heard about this, measures the tunneling current both as a function of the bias and as a function of spatial position near the zinc impurity. The salient feature is that right, very close to the zinc impurity, you see a very sharp peak close to zero bias at around 1.5 MeV near the zinc. And away from the zinc, you see nothing at low energies, but these coherence peaks at whatever, 30 to 50 MeV. So motivated by all the other experimental evidence, I agree just by looking at this, we can't conclude anything. We hypothesize that the most important degree of freedom near the zinc is just this moment, and this moment of spin a half. And it's coupling then to the Bogle-Lebesgue quasi-particles. But this is in the over-doped system, so actually this this hypothesis is before the Alul experiment. So you would then estimate that this should eventually, at low temperatures, there should be condo screening from the Bogle-Lebesgue quasi-particles. Now you can work out simple models of what the tunneling current near a magnetic impurity would be in a D-wave superconductor. And what you find is that this kind of sharp resonant peak is exactly what you get, and the offset, the bias offset of this peak, is of the order of the condo temperature. So I would claim that the fact that this bias offset is 1.5 MeV, or remembering my numbers right, 1.5 MeV was it?
Yeah.
And the condo temperature measured in Alul's experiment, okay, not on the same sample, but which came later and after our paper, is around 20 to 40 K, which is roughly the same scale. And furthermore, if you take the same type of calculation and go to a normal metal, then you get this Fano resonance that's been seen both in our calculation and in experiments with Cormier et al. So the basic scenario that this peak is a sharp signal of this condo resonance in of a spin a half moment in a D-wave superconductor, and it's easy to test. Apart from all kinds of detail of the spatial distribution, you could just raise the temperature a bit above 2040 K, and the quantum resonance should be washed out. And if you're in the normal state, you should start seeing not a sharp peak, but a funnel-like effect, if the moment is there, not totally quenched at that point.
What about magnetic field? Should that suppress that's the
right.
quantum resonance?
Yes, you'd have to put a fairly large field, but okay. I think raising temperature is the simplest thing, and hasn't been done yet.
It just has to be bigger than the condo temperature.
That's right. Yeah, okay, so 1.5.
Okay, but you can get partway there.
Well, just all they have to do is heat the sample. It seems like the simplest thing. So we'll see. Anyway, so in the same model, we can also look at the spatial distribution, and I would claim that very naturally in this model, you get exactly the type of spatial distribution that Seamus sees. Although we just take the simplest model for the tunneling current, we just assume the tunneling current is just the local density of states. So this is a plot of the local density of states. Now Sasha has a picture where he questions that assumption, and that's certainly quite reasonable. But I think the way to settle this is to just raise the temperature, and there's a dramatic difference between the impurity prediction. We just have a unitary limit scatterer and a system with a spin a half moment.
So how is it?
Yes.
Of the particle asymmetry and intensity.
Yes. Yes.
The average of all sites. Do you get asymmetry?
Yes, we do, but not as large as in the experiments.
How
much do you get?
Oh, about a factor of two or something like that. Yeah.
You see your peak on the positive. Side,
that's
no,
right.
There's no peak
scene. Well, okay. You're right. I mean, the very parameters we can make it smaller, but this is just this one thing that you can certainly fiddle things around a bit. But the basic structure is this: the fact that the largest peak is on site, and the second largest peak is on this site. That doesn't change, but a lot of those details will change. This is a very.
That characteristic is not special to. A condo character, so that's
I'm not so sure. I mean, if I take if I just take a simple unitary limit scattering model at the same level of approximation as this theory, you get the large peaks are on the first neighbor site and not on the central site. Now you can get large peaks on the central site if you put in strong scattering, take a non-local potential. But in a sense, I think
if you do the junction envelopes normalization properly.
The what normalization?
The experiment is not a precise measurement of the local density states. There's a junction normalization.
Yes, okay.
On the impurity site.
Okay.
If you do that, then you'll find that, in fact, just with a simple impurity, you'll get an on-site peak.
Which is larger than the next neighbor site.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Because the local density, because of the way they do the experiment,
yes,
they normalize to a certain resistance,
yeah,
voltage of about minus 100 millivolts.
No.
And so if you look at the integrated local density of states over energy at the impurity site, it's very, very small. That means that when they do this junction normalization, they actually move the tip closer to the surface, which makes the signal rise.
All right. I find that hard to believe that they're not presenting properly normalized results.
Well, no, they can't do it.
Takes a distance,
yes,
takes the distance between the sample and the tip.
Yes.
Anyway,
yeah,
you know how to do that is right, at some high voltage.
Yes.
And so you're depending on the, you regulate at a high voltage and then you increase
the right
voltage. All right. No, they basically cannot do the experiment with a fixed pipe going across. That's not...
Well, I mean, they're reporting results for the tunneling conductance as a function of site, and I'm just assuming the tunneling conductance local density. Are you saying that that's...
There's a function that they have to fix the height, and the point is there's no absolute ratio of the height apart from a particular combination of voltage and current. So they'll typically run in an nanoamp,
yes,
voltage of 150.
Right, yeah.
In this case, it's minus 100 millivolts.
Minus 100, yeah.
I still don't understand why there should be a difference between the central site and the near and the first neighbor site in that case.
Because the frequency is a very small scale on the scale of the potential that you have. It's huge.
Yeah.
So the local density of states is actually diminished over that entire energy range. Look, I mean, I've done the calculation. I've published the calculation. You can see it.
Okay. Fine.
So
yes.
Where does the asymmetry come from in your calculation?
From the fact that you're not at half filling, for example, and you also put in a second neighbor exchange, that will also give you an asymmetry.
There's a second neighbor exchange, not at half filling.
Sorry, second neighbor hopping, sorry, yes?
Not at half filling.
No, we're not at half filling.
Yeah, but it wouldn't give you a symmetry between...
We are not at half filling, sorry. We're moving away from, we're, you know, 20% doping or something like that.
But it still would give you the same width of the peak for positive or negative.
No. This is the calculation. this is what we get. Yeah. Right.
I just want to sort of comment where should it be. It's for the benefit of those who will not be able to come. That's exactly.
Yes.
We should sort of clarify about that. it's a quantum mechanical
autonomy. Yeah.
The idea is actually it's a force lead interference pattern you're getting in the key. You're not tunneling directly in the copper oxygen plane. And the result of that, actually, there is this point, actually, at least we believe that there is this highly non-local filter, which essentially samples not directly zinc site, but kind of assembles amplitudes for four neighboring copper sites. So that's the only way to couple arriving S wave, or, you know, electron in the copper oxygen plane with the D-wave orbitals.
So this explanation is a completely different one from what Michael is saying. So it's a... No, okay, I mean, all right.
You guys almost convinced me to ignore the experiment.
No, I mean, okay. All right, my main message is that just raise the temperature. There's a dramatic difference between any condo physics and the impurity scattering, and that will just settle the issue. Furthermore, there's so many other experiments with show moment, so...
Right. No, I'm not arguing against the moment. I'm just going to say that the zinc, when it goes in the copper oxygen plane, goes to the zinc EPM shell, and you pointed out yourself, it's actually a hugely repulsive site.
Yeah.
And because of that, actually, I believe that the potential aspect of this on-site impurity, just black hole in the copper oxygen plane, is a domain of physics.
All right, okay.
So, and then, so the energetics of this level,
yeah,
not affected by any filter. So, and perhaps it's worth to say that the simple potential impurity picture,
yeah,
can account for the peak and the width within factor of three. It's a one parameter theory where if you tell me the position of the peak, I can tell you what the width is, and they're missing by factor of three.
Okay.
No claim is any particle.
All right. Well, I can certainly accept that. I would just say Well, first let's look at the temperature difference and how do you explain the NMR and the neutron scattering.
I have another question. How do you explain, I'm not sure I've understood your explanation for the presence of the moment in the superconducting phase in the first place?
That's what, it's by continuity from this insulator. That was.
So it would be due to some breaking of some antiferromagnetic pairing or some dimer pairing, but you...
Well, I say that suppose we imagine, so the picture is, suppose we imagine that our superconductor is somehow continuously connected to a confining mod insulator with no long-range order. And then that's a smooth connection. Then in the confining mod insulator, when I put in Zeki figure, I know I have a moment. And then when I dope, the only reasonable way I can think of that moment disappearing is at this quantum critical point at finite doping. That's sort of the heart of the whole argument. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, one... Yeah, I mean, you have... This is a system with very strong interactions, and if you just model the zinc impurity by just some unitary limit scatter while ignoring the interaction from all the other sites, I'm not sure that's very reasonable. You really have to start from more a picture where you have strong Coulomb repulsion on every site, as you have in the paramagnetic mode insulator, and move away from it adiabatically.
Or you can take a new data as just empirical evidence.
Well, okay. Sorry?
Is it below closed temperature or a channel? This picture, I suppose, is below closed temperature, right?
Yes. Yeah, so that's precisely what I'm saying. Suppose you raise the temperature above the quantum temperature, you should see a dramatic difference in the tunneling current.
That's right. But well, the data actually, I mean, if you're below quantum temperature, you should display a situation of susceptibility, right? So it's just constant, it shouldn't be anything increasing.
I missed that, I'm sorry. The Alul data what?
So in the Alul data, he sees actually all the way down to low temperatures. There's just increase in susceptibility, which is actually really sharp.
That's here. Okay, so that's in the underdoped. In the overdoped, the susceptibility is saturating. Right. This is saturating the finite value. As you raise the temperature, the susceptibility goes down. This is inverse susceptibility. Sorry, it's not my plot.
If you had condom, then you would just have a plane situation, so you'd have basically a horizontal line.
Well, this is condom on a D-wave, and we just don't understand that problem very well at all. So that's something like, you know, I think that's a very interesting open problem to fully understand with the particle symmetry ring. Sorry, I'm sorry. Yeah.
What we learned is that the experiment is quenched. I mean, nevertheless, we expect it not to have any Curie particle susceptibility. So that's the condom.
Yes.
So if there is some part of growing susceptibility, it would actually be spin is not completely quenched.
It's not, well, there is a spin, but if, okay, you know.
You know, there's no
contact. There's no what?
I don't know. What effect. I mean, even if it is there, it doesn't set down yet at this temperature.
Well, the susceptibility is not diverging. So obviously there is some, there's a sharp question we can ask. Is, you know, independently of all kinds of crossovers at finite temperature, you know, in the Fermi liquid, this sharp question doesn't exist, because in a Fermi liquid, there's never a moment as T goes to zero. You know, and you can have all kinds of very beautiful crossovers having to do with the Kondo effect, but in the zero temperature sense, the Kondo fixed point is a Fermi liquid too. It doesn't have a moment. Okay? But in a D-wave superconductor and in the mod insulator, there is a sharp distinction. There can either be a moment or not a moment as T goes to zero. That's a yes-no question. That's the only yes-no question.
Sorry?
It's a finite value. It's a finite value. It's a null spin.
Okay. Anyway, so the main message is impurities are very interesting and more people to think about it.